one minute to walk back in. One minute.
Flipping on the ME that did that.
Of fresh lemon juice.
Hot.
And we'll, then fold in
what
your
we'll do
cream.
Is cue Jeff and then eventually mix to the picture style.
And when it's all well mixed, place it into
individual
dishes.
Jeff in between
the numbers. Absolutely, yes, mix straight.
Counting out of ET, 10 seconds. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3,
and cue Jeff.
2,
so you'll need a fresh
1,
pineapple, 6
0.
Ounces of marshmallows, 20 maraschino cherries, count them carefully, won't you?
30 seconds,
cream,
drop back in.
Caster sugar and lemon juice.
And mix.
What will come out next? It's the southeast weather.
You could have left the clock,
like it's
doesn't
be another
matter.
Cold, dull day again, much like
20 yesterday. Seconds.
Coming back to 2.
The top temperature, about 4 degrees centigrade or 39 Fahrenheit.
Counting to what back in? 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1,
cut,
0.
Quantel, opt in, go tape.
Here now the words. Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on anonradio.net. This time, we have chapters 14, 15, and 16, so we'll end this show more than halfway through the book. And since we are more than halfway through this book, I do hope you will join me on Sunday for the live stream of our next book, The Moon Pool by Abraham Merritt, which I'm going to tell you now is decidedly longer. We're also going to have another supplement, another snippet of Citadel of Lost Ships by Leigh Brackett, simply because 14, 15, and 16 are all about 15 minutes long, and I don't want to have an embarrassing gap. Now, if you're just joining us for your first show, the Anon Radio archives do have the previous three shows, and I encourage you to listen to those. Now, a couple of notes on the chapters from last time, chapters 10 through 13, which were also quite long. One thing you've undoubtedly noticed by now is that Burroughs has quite the knack for strong chapter endings, we'll just call them that. And that trend absolutely continues in this installment. Now, you may have noticed his statement that there were no mountains of any size on Mars. That was commonly believed by astronomers right up until the Mariner probes reached Mars, and you may be wondering, well, how could anyone miss the great Mount Olympus? The short answer is, it's so shallow that it doesn't have the distinctive marks that an astronomer would look for from ordinary wrinkly mountains. As a matter of fact, it's quite invisible from the surface of the planet, owing to the fact that it has an enormous escarpment at its base and its slope is so shallow. Indeed, when Mariner 9 began to send back photographs of Olympus Mons, it took a very long time for the folks back at JPL to recognize what they were seeing. It turns out that even from orbit, it's difficult to realize that you're looking at a mountain the size of New York State. Now, one other thing you've probably noticed is that the tradition of footnotes in science fiction novels goes back a long way. Alas! What else do we have to say about chapters 10 through 13? Well, it's curious, on the one hand, that he says women do not kill men, nor men women, but on the other hand, he says that a green Martian woman who desired to show her displeasure would have done so with a motion of her trigger finger or a thrust of her sword. Quite the contradiction there. It's interesting that the Martians seem to regard their existence as a zero-sum game, that there is only enough resources to support a small population, and therefore, if I kill you, that means I get to go on living. Rather a dismal worldview, but not one that's unknown here on Earth. And then, well, all I can say is I'm not sure what he means by a slight and occasional loss of chastity. Might be worth finding out, though. Chapter 14, A Duel to the Death. My first impulse was to tell her of my love, and then I thought of the helplessness of her position, wherein I alone could lighten the burdens of her captivity, and protect her in my poor way against the thousands of hereditary enemies she must face upon our arrival at Thark. I could not chance causing her additional pain or sorrow by declaring a love which, in all probability, she did not return. Should I be so indiscreet, her position would be even more unbearable than now, and the thought that she might feel that I was taking advantage of her helplessness to influence her decision was the final argument which sealed my lips. "Why are you so quiet, Dejah Thoris?" I asked. "Possibly you would rather return to Sola and your quarters." "No," she murmured, "I am happy here. I do not know why it is that I should always be happy and contented when you, John Carter, a stranger, are with me, yet at such times it seems that I am safe, and that with you I shall soon return to my father's court, and feel his strong arms about me, and my mother's tears and kisses upon my cheek." "Do people kiss, then, upon Barsoom?" I asked, when she had explained the words she used in answer to my inquiry as to its meaning. "Parents, brothers and sisters, yes, and," she added in a low, thoughtful tone, "lovers." "And you, Dejah Thoris, have parents and brothers and sisters?"
"Yes."
"And a lover?" She was silent, nor could I venture to repeat the question. "The man of Barsoom," she finally ventured, "does not ask personal questions of women, except his mother and the woman he has fought for and won." "But I have fought," I started, and then I wished my tongue had been cut from my mouth. For she turned even as I caught myself and ceased, and drawing my silks from her shoulder, she held them out to me, and without a word, and with head held high, she moved with the carriage of the queen she was toward the plaza and the doorway of her quarters. I did not attempt to follow her other than to see that she reached the building in safety. But, directing Wula to accompany her, I turned disconsolately and entered my own house. I was sat for hours cross-legged and cross-tempered upon my silks, meditating upon the queer freaks chance plays upon us poor devils of mortals. So this was love! I had escaped it for all the years I had roamed the five continents and their encircling seas. In spite of beautiful women and urging opportunity, in spite of a half-desire for love and a constant search for my ideal, it had remained for me to fall furiously and hopelessly in love with a creature from another world, of a species similar possibly, but yet not identical with mine. A woman who was hatched from an egg, and whose span of life might cover 1,000 years. Whose people had strange customs and ideas. A woman whose hopes, whose pleasures, whose standards of virtue and of right and wrong might vary as greatly from mine as did those of the green Martians. Yes, I was a fool, but I was in love, and though I was suffering the greatest misery I had ever known, I would not have had it otherwise for all the riches of Barsoom. Such is love, and such are lovers wherever love is known. To me, Dejah Thoris was all that was perfect, all that was virtuous and beautiful and noble and good. I believe that from the bottom of my heart, from the depths of my soul on that night in Korad as I sat cross-legged upon my silks, while the nearer moon of Barsoom raced through the western sky toward the horizon, and lighted up the gold and marble and jeweled mosaics of my world-old chamber, and I believe it today as I sit at my desk in the little study overlooking the Hudson. 20 years have intervened. For 10 of them I lived and fought for Dejah Thoris and her people, and for 10 have I lived upon her memory. The morning of our departure for Thark dawned clear and hot, as do all Martian mornings except for the 6 weeks when the snow melts at the poles. I sought out Dejah Thoris in the throng of departing chariots, but she turned her shoulder to me, and I could see the red blood mount to her cheek. With the foolish inconsistency of love, I held my peace, when I might have pleaded ignorance of the nature of my offense, or at least the gravity of it, and so have effected at worst a half-conciliation. My duty dictated that I must see that she was comfortable, and so I glanced into her chariot and rearranged her silks and furs. In doing so, I noted with horror that she was heavily chained by one ankle to the side of the vehicle. "What does this mean?" I cried, turning to Sola. "Sarkoja thought it best," she answered, her face betokening the disapproval of the procedure. Examining the manacles, I saw that they were fastened with a massive spring lock. "Where is the key, Sola? Let me have it." "Sarkoja wears it, John Carter," she answered. I turned without further word and sought out Tars Tarkas, to whom I vehemently objected to the unnecessary humiliations and cruelties, as they seemed to my lover's eyes, that were being heaped upon Dejah Thoris.
John Carter, he answered, if ever you and Dejah Thoris escape the Tharks, it will be upon this journey. We know that you will not go without her. You have shown yourself a mighty fighter, and we do not wish to manacle you. So we hold you both in the easiest way that will yet ensure security. I have spoken. I saw the strength of his reasoning at a flash, and knew that it were futile to appeal from his decision, but I asked that this key be taken from Sarkoja, and that she be directed to leave the prisoner alone in future. This much, Tars Tarkas, you may do for me in return for the friendship that I must confess I feel for you. Friendship, he replied. There is no such thing, John Carter, but have your will. I shall direct that Sarkoja cease to annoy the girl, and I myself will take custody of the key. Unless you wish me to assume the responsibility, I said, smiling. He looked at me long and earnestly before he spoke. Were it you to give me your word that neither you nor Dejah Thoris would attempt to escape until after we have safely reached the court of Talhages, you might have the key and throw the chains into the river Iss. It were better that you hold the key, Tars Tarkas, I replied. He smiled and said no more, but that night as we were making camp I saw him unfasten Dejah Thoris' fetters himself. With all his cruel ferocity and coldness, there was an undercurrent of something in Tars Tarkas which he ever seemed battling to subdue. Could it be a vestige of some human instinct come back from an ancient forebear to haunt him with the horror of his people's ways? As I was approaching Dejah Thoris' chariot, I passed Sarkoja, and the black venomous look she accorded me was the sweetest balm I had felt for many hours. Lord, how she hated me! It bristled from her so palpably that one might almost have cut it with a sword. A few moments later, I saw her deep in conversation with a warrior named Zad, a big, hulking, powerful brute, but one who had never made a kill among his own chieftains, and was still an Omad, or man with one name. He could win a second name only with the metal of some chieftain. It was this custom which entitled me to the names of either of the chieftains I had killed. In fact, some of the warriors addressed me as Dotar Sojat, a combination of the surnames of the two warrior chieftains whose metal I had taken, or, in other words, whom I had slain in fair fight. As Sarkoja talked with Zad, he cast occasional glances in my direction, while she seemed to be urging him very strongly to some action. I paid little attention to it at the time, but the next day I had good reason to recall the circumstances, and at the same time gain a slight insight into the depths of Sarkoja's hatred, and the lengths to which she was capable of going to wreak her horrid vengeance on me. Dejah Thoris would have none of me again this evening, and though I spoke her name, she neither replied nor conceded by so much as the flutter of an eyelid that she realized my existence. In my extremity, I did what most other lovers would have done. I sought word from her through an intimate. In this instance, it was Sola whom I intercepted in another part of the camp. "What is the matter with Dejah Thoris?" I blurted out at her. "Why will she not speak to me?" Sola seemed puzzled herself, as though such strange actions on the part of two humans were quite beyond her, as indeed they were, poor child. "She says that you have angered her, and it is all she will say, except that she is the daughter of a Jed and the granddaughter of a Jeddak, and she has been humiliated by a creature who could not polish the teeth of her grandmother's Sorak." I pondered over this report for some time, finally asking, "What might a Sorak be, Sola?" "A little animal about as big as my hand, which the red women keep to play with," explained Sola. "Not fit to polish the teeth of her grandmother's cat?" I must rank pretty low in the consideration of Dejah Thoris, I thought, but I could not help laughing at the strange figure of speech, so homely, and in this respect so earthly. It made me homesick, for it sounded very much like "not fit to polish her shoes." And then commenced a train of thought quite new to me. I began to wonder what my people at home were doing. I had not seen them for years. There was a family of Carters in Virginia who claimed close relationship with me. I was supposed to be a great uncle or something of the kind equally foolish. I could pass for anywhere for 25 to 30 years of age, and to be a great uncle always seemed the height of incongruity, for my thoughts and feelings were those of a boy. There were two little kiddies in the Carter family whom I loved, and who had thought there was no one on earth like Uncle Jack. I could see them just as plainly as I stood there under the moonlit skies of Barsoom, and I longed for them as I had never longed for any mortal before. By nature a wanderer, I had never known the true meaning of the word home, but the great hall of the Carters had always stood for all that the word did mean to me, and now my heart turned toward them from the cold and unfriendly peoples I had been thrown amongst. For did not even Dejah Thoris despise me? I was a low creature, so low in fact that I was not even finished fit to polish the teeth of her grandmother's cat. And then my saving sense of humor came to my rescue, and laughing, I turned into my silks and furs and slept upon the moon-haunted ground the sleep of a tired and healthy fighting man. We broke camp the next day at an early hour, and marched with only a single halt until just before dark. two incidents broke the tediousness of the march. At about noon, we espied to our right what was evidently an incubator, and Lorquast Tomal directed Tars Tarkas to investigate it. The latter took a dozen warriors, including myself, and we raced across the velvety carpeting of moss to the little enclosure. It was indeed an incubator, but the eggs were very small in comparison with those I had seen hatching in hours at the time of our arrival on Mars. Tars Tarkas dismounted and examined the enclosure minutely, finally announcing that it belonged to the Green Men of Warhoon, and that the cement was scarcely dry where it had been walled up. "They cannot be a day's march ahead of us!" he exclaimed, the light of battle leaping to his face. The work at the incubator was short indeed. The warriors tore open the entrance, and a couple of them, crawling in, soon demolished all the eggs with their short swords. Then, remounting, we dashed back to join the cavalcade. During the ride, I took occasion to ask Tars Tarkas if these Warhoons, whose eggs we had destroyed, were smaller people than his Tharks. I noticed that their eggs were so much smaller than those I saw hatching in your incubator. He explained that the eggs had just been placed there, but like all green Martian eggs, they would grow during the 5-year period of incubation until they attained the size of those I had seen hatching on the day of my arrival on Barsoom. This was indeed an interesting piece of information, for it had always seemed remarkable to me that the green Martian women, large as they were, could bring forth such enormous eggs as I had seen the 4-foot infants emerging from. As a matter of fact, the new-laid egg is but little larger than an ordinary goose egg, and as it does not commence to grow until subjected to the light of the sun, the chieftains have little difficulty in transporting several hundreds of them at one time from the storage vaults to the incubators. Shortly after the incident of the Warhoon eggs, we halted to rest the animals, and it was during this halt that the second of the day's interesting episodes occurred. I was engaged in changing my riding cloths from one of my thoats to the other, for I divided the day's work between them, when Zad approached me, and without a word, struck my animal a terrific blow with his longsword. I did not need a manual of green Martian etiquette to know what reply to make, for in fact I was so wild with anger that I could scarcely refrain from drawing my pistol and shooting him down for the brute he was. But he stood waiting with drawn longsword, and my only choice was to draw my own and meet him in fair fight with his choice of weapons or a lesser one. The latter alternative is always permissible, therefore I could have used my short sword, my dagger, my hatchet, or my fists had I wished, and been entirely within my rights, but I could not use firearms or a spear while he held only his longsword. I chose the same weapon he had drawn, because I knew he prided himself upon his ability with it, and I wished, if I worsted him at all, to do it with his own weapon. The fight that followed was a long one, and delayed the resumption of the march for an hour. The entire community surrounded us, leaving a clear space about 100 feet in diameter for our battle. Zad first attempted to rush me down as a bull might a wolf, but I was much too quick for him, and each time I sidestepped his rushes, he would go lunging past me, only to receive a nick from my sword upon his arm or back. He was soon streaming blood from half a dozen minor wounds, but I could not obtain an opening to deliver an effective thrust. Then he changed his tactics, and fighting warily and with extreme dexterity, he tried to do by science what he was unable to do by brute strength. I must admit that he was a magnificent swordsman, and had it not been for my greater endurance, and the remarkable agility the lesser gravitation of Mars left me, I might not have been able to put up the creditable fight that I did against him. We circled for some time without doing much damage on either side, the long, straight, needle-like swords flashing in the sunlight, and ringing out upon the stillness as they crashed together with each effective parry. Finally, Zad, realizing that he was tiring more than I, evidently decided to close in and end the battle in a final blaze of glory for himself. Just as he rushed me, a blinding flash of light struck full in my eyes so that I could not see his approach, and could only leap blindly to one side in an effort to escape the mighty blade that it seemed I could already feel in my vitals. I was only partially successful, as a sharp pain in my left shoulder attested, but in the sweep of my glance as I sought to again locate my adversary, a sight met my astonished gaze, which paid me well for the wound the temporary blindness had caused me. There, upon Dejah Thoris' chariot, stood three figures, for the purpose evidently of witnessing the encounter above the heads of the intervening Tharks. There were Dejah Thoris, Sola, and Sarkoja, and as my fleeting glance swept over them, a little tableau was presented which will stand graven in my memory to the day of my death. As I looked, Dejah Thoris turned upon Sarkoja with the fury of a young tigress and struck something from her upraised hand, something which flashed in the sunlight as it spun to the ground. Then I knew what had blinded me at that crucial moment of the fight, and how Sarkoja had found a way to kill me without herself delivering the final thrust. Another thing I saw, too, which almost lost my life for me then and there, for it took my mind for the moment, fraction of an instant, entirely from my antagonist. For, as Dejah Thoris struck the tiny mirror from her hand, Sarkoja, her face livid with hatred and baffled rage, whipped out her dagger and aimed a terrific blow at Dejah Thoris. And then Sola, our dear and faithful Sola, sprang between them. The last I saw was the great knife descending upon her shielding breast. My enemy had recovered from his thrust, and was making it extremely interesting for me, so I reluctantly gave my attention to the work at hand, but my mind was not upon the battle. We rushed upon each other furiously time after time, till suddenly, feeling the sharp point of his sword at my breast in a thrust I could neither parry nor escape, I threw myself upon him with outstretched sword and with all the weight of my body, determined that I would not die alone if I could prevent it. I felt the steel tear into my chest. All went black before me, my head whirled in dizziness, and I felt my knees giving beneath me. Chapter 15. Sola Tells Me Her Story. When consciousness returned, and, as I soon learned, I was down but a moment, I sprang quickly to my feet, searching for my sword, and there I found it, buried to the hilt in the green breast of Zad, who lay stone dead upon the ochre moss of the ancient sea bottom. As I regained my full senses, I found his weapon piercing my left breast, but only through the flesh and muscles which cover my ribs, entering near the center of my chest and coming out below the shoulder. As I had lunged, I had turned so that his sword merely passed beneath the muscles, inflicting a painful but not dangerous wound. Removing the blade from my body, I also regained my own, and turning my back upon his ugly carcass, I moved, sick, sore, and disgusted, toward the chariots which bore my retinue and my belongings. A murmur of Martian applause greeted me, but I cared not for it. Bleeding and weak, I reached my women, who, accustomed to such happenings, dressed my wounds, applying the wonderful healing and remedial agents, which make only the most instantaneous of death blows fatal. Give a Martian woman a chance, and death must take a back seat. They soon had me patched up so that, except for weakness from loss of blood and a little soreness around the wound, I suffered no great distress from this thrust, which, under earthly treatment, undoubtedly would have put me flat on my back for days. As soon as they were through with me, I hastened to the chariot of Dejah Thoris, where I found my poor Sola with her chest swathed in bandages, but apparently little the worse for her encounter with Sarkoja, whose dagger, it seemed, had struck the edge of one of Sola's metal breast ornaments and, thus deflected, had inflicted but a slight flesh wound. As I approached, I found Dejah Thoris lying prone upon her silks and furs, her lithe form racked with sobs. She did not notice my presence, nor did she hear me speaking with Sola, who was standing a short distance from the vehicle. "Is she injured?" I asked of Sola, indicating Dejah Thoris by an inclination of my head. "No," she answered. "She thinks that you are dead." "And that her grandmother's cat may now have no one to polish its teeth?" I queried, smiling. "I think you wrong her, John Carter," said Sola. "I do not understand her either her ways or yours, but I am sure the granddaughter of 10,000 jeddaks would never grieve like this over the death of one she considered beneath her, or indeed over any who held but the highest claim upon her affections. They are a proud race, but they are just, as are all Barsoomians, and you must have hurt or wronged her grievously that she will not admit your existence living, though she mourns you dead. Tears are a strange sight upon Barsoom," she continued, "and so it is difficult for me to interpret them. I have seen but two people weep in all my life, other than Dejah Thoris. One wept from sorrow, the other from baffled rage. The first was my mother, years ago, before they killed her. The other was Sarkoja, when they dragged her from me today." "Your mother!" I explained. "But, Sola, you could not have known your mother, child." "But I did." "And my father also," she added. "If you would like to hear the strange and un-Barsoomian story, you may come to the chariot tonight, John Carter, and I will tell you that of which I have never spoken in all my life before. And now the signal has been given to resume the march. You must go." "I will come tonight, Sola," I promised. "Be sure to tell Dejah Thoris I am alive and well. I shall not force myself upon her, and be sure that you do not let her know I saw her tears. If she would speak with me, I but await her command." Sola mounted the chariot, which was swinging into its place in line, and I hastened to my waiting thote and galloped to my station beside Tars Tarkas at the rear of the column. We made a most imposing and awe-inspiring spectacle as we strung out across the yellow landscape. The 250 ornate and highly colored chariots, preceded by an advance guard of some 200 mounted warriors and chieftains riding 5 abreast and 100 yards apart, and followed by a like number in the same formation, with a score or more of flankers on either side. The 50 extra mastodons, or heavy draft animals known as zitadars, and 500 or 600 extra thoats of the warriors running loose within the hollow square formed by the surrounding warriors. The gleaming metal and jewels of the gorgeous ornaments of the men and women, duplicated in the trappings of the zitadars and thoats, and interspersed with the flashing colors of magnificent silks and furs and feathers, lent a barbaric splendor to the caravan which would have turned an East Indian potentate green with envy. The enormous broad tires of the chariots, and the padded feet of the animals, brought forth no sound from the moss-covered sea bottom, and so we moved in utter silence like some huge phantasmagoria, except when the stillness was broken by the guttural growling of a goaded zitadar, or the squealing of fighting thoats. The green Martians converse but little, and then usually in monosyllables, low and like the faint rumbling of distant thunder. We traversed a trackless waste of moss, which, bending to the pressure of broad tire or padded foot, rose up again behind us, leaving no sign that we had passed. We might indeed have been the wraiths of the departed dead upon the Dead Sea of that dying planet, for all the sound or sign we made in passing. It was the first march of a large body of men and animals I had ever witnessed, which raised no dust and left no spoor, for there is no dust upon Mars except in the cultivated districts during the winter months, and even then, in the absence of high winds, renders it almost unnoticeable. We camped that night at the foot of the hills we had been approaching for 2 days, and which marked the southern boundary of this particular sea. Our animals had been 2 days without drink, nor had they water for nearly 2 months, not since shortly after leaving Thark. But, as Tars Tarkas explained to me, they require but little, and can live almost indefinitely upon the moss which covers Barsoom, and which, he told me, holds in its tiny stems sufficient moisture to meet the limited demands of the animals. After partaking of my evening meal of cheese-like food and vegetable milk, I sought out Solo, whom I found working, by the light of a torch, upon some of Tars Tarkas' trappings. She looked up at my approach, her face lighting with pleasure and with welcome. "I'm glad you came," she said. "Dejah Thoris sleeps, and I am lonely. Mine own people do not care for me, John Carter. I am too unlike them. It is a sad fate, since I must live my life amongst them, and I often wish that I were a true green Martian woman, without love and without hope. But I have known love, and so I am lost. I promise to tell you my story, or rather the story of my parents. From what I have learned of you and the ways of your people, I am sure that the tale will not seem strange to you, but among green Martians it has no parallel within the memory of the oldest living Thark, nor do our legends hold many similar tales. My mother was rather small, in fact too small to be allowed the responsibilities of maternity, as our chieftains breed principally for size. She was also less cold and cruel than most green Martian women, and caring little for their society, she often roamed the deserted avenues of Thark alone, or went and sat among the wild flowers that deck the nearby hills, thinking thoughts and wishing wishes, which I believe I alone among Tharkian women today may understand, for am I not the child of my mother? And there among the hills she met a young warrior, whose duty it was to guard the feeding zitadars and thoats, and see that they roamed not beyond the hills. They spoke at first only of such things as interest a community of Tharks, but gradually, as they came to meet more often, and as was now quite evident to both, no longer by chance, they talked about themselves, their likes, their ambitions, and their hopes. She trusted him and told him of her awful repugnance she felt for the cruelties of their kind, for the hideous, loveless lives they must ever lead, and then she waited for the storm of denunciation to break from his cold, hard lips, but instead he took her in his arms and kissed her. They kept their love a secret for 6 long years. She, my mother, was of the retinue of the great Talhages, while her lover was a simple warrior, wearing only his own metal. Had their defection from the traditions of the Tharks been discovered, both would have paid the penalty in the great arena before Talhages and the assembled hordes. The egg from which I came was hidden beneath a great glass vessel upon the highest and most inaccessible of the partially ruined towers of ancient Thark. Once each year my mother visited it, for the 5 long years it lay there in the process of incubation. She dared not come oftener, for in the mighty guilt of her conscience she feared that her every move was watched. During this period my father gained great distinction as a warrior, and had taken the metal from several chieftains. His love for my mother had never diminished, and his one ambition in life was to reach a point where he might wrest the metal from Talhages himself, and thus, as ruler of the Tharks, be free to claim her as his own, as well as, by the might of his power, protect the child which otherwise would be quickly dispatched should the truth become known. It was a wild dream, that of wresting the metal from Talhages in 5 short years, but his advance was rapid, and he soon stood high in the councils of Thark. But one day the chance was lost forever, in so far as it could come in time to save his loved ones, for he was ordered away upon a long expedition to the ice-cold south, to make war upon the natives there and despoil them of their furs, for such is the manner of the green Barsoomian, he does not labor for what he can wrest in battle from others. He was gone for 4 years, and when he returned, all had been over for three. For about a year after his departure, and shortly before the time for the return of an expedition, which had gone forth to fetch the fruits of the community incubator, the egg had hatched. Thereafter, my mother continued to keep me in the old tower, visiting me nightly, and lavishing upon me the love the community life would have robbed me of. She hoped, upon the return of the expedition from the incubator, to mix me with the other young assigned to the quarters of Talhages, and thus escape the fate which would surely follow discovery of her sin against the ancient traditions of the green men. She taught me rapidly the language and customs of my kind, and one night she told me the story I have told you up to this point, impressing upon me the necessity for absolute secrecy, and the great caution I must exercise after she had placed me with the other young Tharks, to permit no one to guess that I was further advanced in education than they, nor by any sign to divulge in the presence of others my affection for her, or my knowledge of her parentage, and then drawing me close to her, whispered in my ear the name of my father. And then a light flashed out in the darkness of the tower chamber, and there stood Sarkoja, her gleaming, baleful eyes fixed in a frenzy of loathing and contempt upon my mother. The torrent of hatred and abuse she poured out upon her turned my young heart cold in terror. That she had heard the entire story was apparent, and that she had suspected something wrong from my mother's long nightly absences from her quarters accounted for her presence there on that fateful night. One thing she had not heard, nor did she know, the whispered name of my father. This was apparent from her repeated demands upon my mother to disclose the name of her partner in sin, but no amount of abuse or threats could wring this from her, and to save me from needless tortures she lied, for she told Sarkoja that she alone knew, nor would she even tell her child. With final imprecations, Sarkoja hastened away to Talhages to report her discovery, and while she was gone, my mother, wrapping me in the silks and furs of her night covering so that I was barely noticeable, descended into the streets and ran wildly away toward the outskirts of the city, in the direction of which led to the far south, out toward the man whose protection she might not claim, but on whose face she wished to look once more before she died. As we neared the city's southern extremity, a sound came to us from across the mossy flat, from the direction of the only pass through the hills which led to the gates, the pass by which caravans from either north or south or east or west would enter the city. The sounds we heard were the squealing of thoats and the grumbling of zitadars, with the occasional clank of arms, which announced the approach of a body of warriors. The thought uppermost in her mind was that it was my father returning from his expedition, but the cunning of the Thark held her from headlong and precipitate flight to greet him. Retreating into the shadows of a doorway, she awaited the coming of the cavalcade, which shortly entered the avenue, breaking its formation and thronging the thoroughfare from wall to wall. As the head of the procession passed us, the lesser moon swung clear of the overhanging roofs and lit up the scene with all the brilliancy of her wondrous light. My mother shrunk further back into the friendly shadows, and from her hiding place saw that the expedition was not that of my father's, but the returning caravan bearing the young Tharks. Instantly her plan was formed. And as a great chariot swung close to our hiding place, she slipped stealthily in upon the trailing tailboard, couching low in the shadow of the high side, straining me to her bosom in a frenzy of love. She knew what I did not, that never again after that night would she hold me to her breast, nor was it likely we would ever look upon each other's face again. In the confusion of the plaza, she mixed me with the other children, whose guardians during the journey were now free to relinquish their responsibility. We were herded together into a great room, fed by women who had not accompanied the expedition, and the next day we were parceled out amongst the retinues of the chieftains. I never saw my mother after that night. She was imprisoned by Talhages, and every effort, including the most horrible and shameful torture, was brought to bear upon her, to wring from her lips the name of my father. But she remained steadfast and loyal, dying at last amidst the laughter of Talhages and his chieftains during some awful torture she was undergoing. I learned afterwards that she told them that she had killed me to save me from a like fate at their hands, and that she had thrown my body to the white apes. Sarkoja alone disbelieved her, and I feel to this day that she suspects my true origin, but does not dare expose me at the present, at all events, because she also guesses, I am sure, the identity of my father. When he returned from his expedition and learned the story of my mother's fate, I was present as Talhages told him, but never by the quiver of a muscle did he betray the slightest emotion. Not only did he not laugh as Talhages gleefully described her death struggles. From that moment on he was the cruelest of the cruel, and I am awaiting the day when he shall win the goal of his ambition and feel the carcass of Talhages beneath his foot, for I am as sure that he but waits the opportunity to wreak a terrible vengeance, and that his great love is as strong in his breast as when it first transfigured him nearly 40 years ago, as I am that we sit here upon the edge of a world-old ocean while sensible people sleep. John Carter. And your father, Sola, is he with us now? I asked. Yes, she replied. But he does not know me for who I am, nor does he know who betrayed my mother to Talhaegis. I alone know my father's name, and only I and Talhaegis and Sarkoja know that it was she who carried the tale that brought death and torture upon her he loved. We sat silent for a few moments, she wrapped in the gloomy thoughts of her terrible past, and I in pity for the poor creatures whom the heartless, senseless customs of their race had doomed to loveless lives of cruelty and of hatred. Presently, she spoke. John Carter, if ever a real man walked the cold, dead bosom of Barsoom, you are one. I know that I can trust you, and because the knowledge may some day help you, or him, or Deja Thoris, or myself, I am going to tell you the name of my father, nor place any restrictions or conditions upon your tongue. When the time comes, speak the truth if it seems best to you. I trust you because I know that you are not cursed with the terrible trait of absolute and unswerving truthfulness, that you could lie like one of your own Virginia gentlemen if a lie would save others from sorrow or suffering. My father's name is Tars Tarkas. Chapter 16. We Plan Escape. The remainder of our journey to Thark was uneventful. We were 20 days upon the road, crossing two sea bottoms and passing through or around a number of more ruined cities, mostly smaller than Korad. Twice we crossed the famous Martian waterways or canals, so called by our earthly astronomers. When we approached these points, a warrior would be sent far ahead with a powerful field glass, and if no great body of red Martian troops was in sight, we would advance as close as possible without chance of being seen, and then camp until dark, when we would slowly approach the cultivated tract and, locating one of the numerous broad highways which crossed these areas at regular intervals, creep silently and stealthily across to the arid lands upon the other side. It required 5 hours to make one of these crossings without a single halt, and the other consumed the entire night, so that we were just leaving the confines of the high-walled fields when the sun broke out upon us. Crossing in the darkness as we did, I was unable to see but little, except as the nearer moon, in her wild and ceaseless hurtling through the Barsoomian heavens, lit up little patches of the landscape from time to time, disclosing walled fields and low, rambling buildings, presenting much the appearance of earthly farms. There were many trees methodically arranged, and some of them were of enormous height. There were animals in some of the enclosures, and they announced their presence by terrified squealings and snortings as they scented our queer wild beasts and wilder human beings. Only once did I perceive a human being, and that was at the intersection of our crossroad with a regular white turnpike which cuts each cultivated district longitudinally at its exact center. This fellow must have been sleeping upon the road, for as I came abreast of him, he raised up upon one elbow, and after a single glance at the approaching caravan, leapt shrieking to his feet and fled madly down the road, scaling a nearby wall with the agility of a scared cat. The Tharks paid him not the slightest attention. They were not upon the warpath, and the only sign that I had that they had seen him was a quickening of the pace of the caravan as we hastened toward the bordering desert which marked our entrance into the realm of Talhaegis. Not once did I have speech with Deja Thoris, as she sent no word to me that I would be welcome at her chariot, and my foolish pride kept me from making any advances. I verily believe that a man's way with women is in inverse ratio to his prowess among men. The weakling and the saphead have often great ability to charm the fair sex, while the fighting man who can face 1,000 real dangers unafraid sits hiding in the shadows like some frightened child. Just 30 days after my advent upon Barsoom, we entered the ancient city of Thark, from whose long-forgotten people this horde of green men have stolen even their name. The hordes of Thark number some 30,000 souls, and are divided into 25 communities. Each community has its own Jed and lesser chieftains, but all are under the rule of Talhaegis, Jeddak of Thark. 5 communities make their headquarters at the city of Thark, and the balance are scattered among other deserted cities of ancient Mars throughout the district claimed by Talhaegis. We made our entry into the great central plaza early in the afternoon. There were no enthusiastic, friendly greetings for the returned expedition. Those who chanced to be in sight spoke the names of warriors or women with whom they came in direct contact, in the formal greeting of their kind, but when it was discovered that they brought 2 captives, a greater interest was aroused, and Deja Thoris and I were the centers of inquiring groups. We were soon assigned to new quarters, and the balance of the day was devoted to settling ourselves to the changed conditions. My home now was upon an avenue leading into the plaza from the south, the main artery down which we had marched from the gates of the city. I was at the far end of the square and had an entire building to myself. The same grandeur of architecture which was so noticeable a characteristic of Korad was in evidence here, only if that were possible on a larger and richer scale. My quarters would have been suitable for housing the greatest of earthly emperors, but to these queer creatures nothing about a building appealed to them but the size and enormity of its chambers. The larger the building, the more desirable. And so Talhages occupied what must have been an enormous public building, the largest in the city, but entirely unfitted for residence purposes. The next largest was reserved for Lorquas Ptomal, the next for the Jed of lesser rank, and so on, to the bottom of the list of five Jeds. The warriors occupied the buildings with the chieftains to whose retinues they belonged, or, if they preferred, sought shelter among any of the thousands of unintended buildings in their own quarter of town, each community being assigned a certain section of the city. The selection of buildings had to be made in accordance with these divisions, except insofar as the Jeds were concerned, they all occupying edifices which fronted upon the plaza. When I had finally put my house in order, or rather seen that it had been done, it was nearing sunset, and I hastened out with the intention of locating Sola and her charges, as I had determined upon having speech with Dejah Thoris, and trying to impress on her the necessity of our at least patching up a truce, until I could find some way of aiding her to escape. I searched in vain until the upper rim of the great red sun was just disappearing behind the horizon, and then I spied the ugly head of Wula peering from a second-story window on the opposite side of the very street where I was quartered, but nearer the plaza. Without waiting for further invitation, I bolted up the winding runway which led to the second floor, and entering a great chamber at the front of the building, was greeted by the frenzied Wula, who threw his great carcass upon me, nearly hurling me to the floor. The poor old fellow was so glad to see me that I thought he would devour me, his head split from ear to ear, showing his three rows of tusks in his hobgoblin smile. Quieting him with a word of command and a caress, I looked hurriedly through the approaching gloom for a sign of Dejah Thoris, and then, not seeing her, I called her name. There was an answering murmur from the far corner of the apartment, and with a couple of quick strides I was standing beside her, where she sat crouched among the furs and silks upon an ancient carved wooden seat. As I waited, she rose to her full height, and looking me straight in the eye, said, "What would Dotar Sojat, Thark, of Dejah Thoris, his captive?" "Dejah Thoris? I do not know how I have angered you. It was furthest from my desire to hurt or offend you, whom I had hoped to protect and comfort. Have none of me if it is your will, but that you must aid me in effecting your escape, if such a thing be possible, is not my request, but my command. When you are safe once more at your father's court, you may do with me as you please, but from now on until that day I am your master, and you must obey and aid me." She looked at me long and earnestly, and I thought she was softening towards me. "I understand your words, Dotar Sojat," she replied, "but you I do not understand. You are a queer mixture of child and man, of brute and noble. I only wish that I might read your heart." "Look down at your feet, Dejah Thoris. It lies there now where it has lain since that other night at Korad, and it will ever lie, beating alone for you, until death stills it forever." She took a little step toward me, her beautiful hands outstretched in a strange, groping gesture. "What do you mean, John Carter?" she whispered. "What are you saying to me?" "I am saying what I had promised myself that I would not say to you, at least until we were no longer a captive among the green men. What from your attitude toward me for the past 20 days I had no thought ever to say to you. I am saying, Dejah Thoris, that I am yours, body and soul, to serve you, to fight for you, and to die for you. Only one thing I ask of you in return, and that is that you make no sign, either of condemnation or of approbation of my words, until you are safe among your own people, and whatever sentiments you harbor toward me, they be not influenced or colored by gratitude. Whatever I may do to serve you will be prompted solely from selfish motives, since it gives me more pleasure to serve you than not." "I will respect your wishes, John Carter, because I understand the motives which prompt them, and I accept your service no more willingly than I bow to your authority. Your word shall be my law. I have twice wronged you in my thoughts, and again I ask your forgiveness." Further conversation of a personal nature was prevented by the entrance of Sola, who was much agitated and wholly unlike her usual calm and possessed self. "That horrible Sarkoja has been before Talhages," she cried, "and from what I heard upon the plaza, there is little hope for either of you." "What do they say?" inquired Dejah Thoris. "That you will be thrown to the wild calots in the great arena as soon as the hordes have assembled for the yearly games." "Sola," I said, "you are a Thark, but you hate and loathe the customs of your people as much as we do. Will you not accompany us in one supreme effort to escape? I am sure that Dejah Thoris can offer you a home and protection among her people, and your fate can be no worse among them than it must ever be here. Yes, cried Dejah Thoris. Come with us, Sola. You will be better off among the red men of Helium than you are here, and I can promise you not only a home with us, but the love and affection your nature craves, and which must always be denied you by the customs of your own race. Come with us, Sola. We might go without you, but your fate would be terrible if they thought that you had connived to aid us. I know that even that fear would not tempt you to interfere in our escape, but we want you with us. We want you to come to a land of sunshine and happiness, amongst a people who know the meaning of love, of sympathy, and of gratitude. Say that you will, Sola. Tell me that you will. The great waterway which leads to Helium is but 50 miles to the south, muttered Sola, half to herself. A swift thought might make it in 3 hours, and then to Helium it is 500 miles most of the way through thinly settled districts. They would know, and they would follow us. We might hide among the great trees for a while, but the chances are small indeed for escape. They would follow us to the very gates of Helium, and they would take a toll of life at every step. You do not know them. Is there no other way we might reach Helium? I asked. Can you not draw me a rough map of the country we must traverse, Dejah Thoris? Yes, she replied, and taking a great diamond from her hair, she drew upon the marble floor the first map of Barsoomian territory I had ever seen. It was crisscrossed in every direction with long, straight lines, sometimes running parallel and sometimes converging toward some great circle. The lines, she said, were waterways, the circles, cities, and one, far to the northwest of us, she pointed out as Helium. There were other cities closer, but she said she feared to enter many of them, as they were not all friendly toward Helium. Finally, after studying the map carefully in the moonlight which now flooded the room, I pointed out a waterway far to the north of us, which also seemed to lead to Helium. Does this not pierce your grandfather's territory? I asked. Yes, she answered, but it is 200 miles north of us. It is one of the waterways we crossed on our trip to Thark. They would never suspect that we would try for that distant waterway, I answered, and that is why I think that it is the best route for our escape. Sola agreed with me, and it was decided that we should leave Thark this same night, just as quickly, in fact, as I could find and saddle my thoats. Sola was to ride one, and Dejah Thoris and I the other, each of us carrying sufficient food and drink to last us 2 days, since the animals could not be urged too rapidly over such a long distance. I directed Sola to proceed with Dejah Thoris along one of the less frequented avenues to the southern boundary of the city, where I would overtake them with the thoats as quickly as possible. Then, leading them to gather what food, silks, and furs we were to need, I slipped quietly to the rear of the first floor, and entered the courtyard where our animals were moving restlessly about, as was their habit, before settling down for the night. In the shadows of the buildings, and out beneath the radiance of the Martian moons, moved the great herd of thoats and zitidars, the latter grunting their low gutturals, and the former occasionally emitting the sharp squeal which denotes the almost habitual state of rage in which these creatures pass their existence. They were quieter now, owing to the absence of man, but as they scented me they became more restless, and their hideous noise increased. It was risky business, this entering a paddock of thoats alone at night, first because their increasing noisiness might warn the nearby warriors that something was amiss, and also because for the slightest cause, or for no cause at all, some great bull thoat might take it upon himself to lead a charge upon me. Having no desire to awaken their nasty tempers upon such a night as this, when so much depended upon secrecy and dispatch, I hugged the shadows of the buildings, ready at an instant's warning to leap into the safety of a nearby door or window. Thus I moved silently to the great gates which opened upon the street at the back of the court, and as I neared the exit I called softly to my own two animals. How I thanked the kind providence which had given me the foresight to win the love and confidence of these wild dumb brutes, for presently from the far side of the court I saw two huge bulks forcing their way toward me through the surging mountains of flesh. They came quite close to me, rubbing their muzzles against my body, and nosing for the bits of food it was always my practice to reward them with. Opening the gates, I ordered the two great beasts to pass out, and then, slipping quietly after them, I closed the portals behind me. I did not saddle or mount the animals there, but instead walked quietly in the shadows of the buildings toward an unfrequented avenue which led toward the point I had arranged to meet Dejah Thoris and Sola. With the noiselessness of disembodied spirits, we moved stealthily along the deserted streets, but not until we were within sight of the plain beyond the city did I commence to breathe freely. I was sure that Sola and Dejah Thoris would find no difficulty in reaching our rendezvous undetected, but with my great thoughts I was not so sure for myself, as it was quite unusual for warriors to leave the city after dark. In fact, there was no place for them to go within any but a long ride. I reached the appointed meeting place safely, but as Dejah Thoris and Sola were not there, I led my animals into the entrance hall of one of the large buildings. Presuming that one of the other women of the same household may have come in to speak to Sola, and so delay their departure, I did not feel any undue apprehension until nearly an hour had passed without a sign of them. And by the time another half hour had crawled away, I was becoming filled with grave anxiety. Then there broke upon the stillness of the night the sound of an approaching party, which, from the noise, I knew could be no fugitives creeping stealthily toward liberty. Soon the party was near me, and from the black shadows of my entranceway I perceived a score of mounted warriors, who, in passing, dropped a dozen words that fetched my heart clean into the top of my head. He would likely have arranged to meet them just without the city, and so I heard no more. They had passed on, but it was enough. Our plan had been discovered, and the chances for escape from now on to the fearful end would be small indeed. My one hope now was to return undetected to the quarters of Dejah Thoris and learn what fate had overtaken her. But how to do it with these great monstrous thoats upon my hands, now that the city probably was aroused by the knowledge of my escape, was a problem of no mean proportions. Suddenly, an idea occurred to me. Acting on my knowledge of the construction of the buildings of these ancient Martian cities, with a hollow court within the center of each square, I groped my way blindly through the dark chambers, calling the great thoats after me. They had difficulty in negotiating some of the doorways, but as the buildings fronting the city's principal exposures were all designed upon a magnificent scale, they were able to wriggle through without sticking fast, and thus we finally made the inner court, where I found, as I had expected, the usual carpet of moss-like vegetation which would provide their food and drink until I could return them to their own enclosure. That they would be as quiet and contented here as elsewhere I was confident, nor was there but the remotest possibility that they would be discovered, as the green men had no great desire to enter these outlying buildings, which were frequented by the only thing, I believe, which caused them the sensation of fear, the great white apes of Barsoom. Removing the saddle trappings, I hid them just within the rear doorway of the building through which we had entered the court, and turning the beast loose, quickly made my way across the court to the rear of the buildings upon the further side, and thence to the avenue beyond. Waiting in the doorway of the building until I was assured that no one was approaching, I hurried across to the opposite side and through the first doorway to the court beyond. Thus, crossing through court after court with only the slightest chance of detection which the necessary crossing of the avenues entailed, I made my way in safety to the courtyard in the rear of Dejah Thoris' quarters. Here, of course, I found the beasts of the warriors who were quartered in the adjacent buildings, and the warriors themselves I might expect to meet within if I entered. But fortunately for me, I had another and safer method of reaching the upper story where Dejah Thoris should be found, and, after first determining as nearly as possible which of the buildings she occupied, for I had never observed them before from the court side, I took advantage of my relatively great strength and agility, and sprang upwards until I grasped the sill of a second-story window, which I thought to be in the rear of her apartment. Drawing myself inside the room, I moved stealthily toward the front of the building, and not until I had quite reached the doorway of her room was I made aware by voices that it was occupied. I did not rush headlong in, but listened without to assure myself that it was Dejah Thoris and that it was safe to venture within. It was indeed that I took this precaution, for the conversation I heard was in the low gutturals of men, and the words which finally came to me proved a most timely warning. The speaker was a chieftain, and he was giving orders to four of his warriors. "And when he returns to this chamber," he was saying, "as he surely will when he finds she does not meet him at the city's edge, you four are to spring upon him and disarm him. It will require the combined strength of all of you to do it if the reports they bring back from Korad are correct. When you have him fast bound, bear him to the vaults beneath the Jeddak's quarters and chain him securely where he may be found when Talhages wishes him. Allow him to speak with none, nor permit any other to enter this apartment before he comes. There will be no danger of the girl returning, for by this time she is safe in the arms of Talhages, and may all her ancestors have pity upon her, for Talhages will have none. The great Sarkoja has done a noble night's work. I go, and if you fail to capture him when he comes, I commend your carcasses to the cold bosom of Iss."
It was a long time since anyone had spoken. The drumming had stopped, but the echo of it throbbed in Campbell's pulses. He looked at his spread, sinewy hands on his knees and swallowed, because the veins of his neck were swollen and hurting. Presently he said, "Couldn't you go further back into the swamps?" The old Kralin spoke without moving. He still stood in the doorway, watching the trees sway in the slow wind. "The Nahali live there. Besides, there is no clean water and no earth for crops. We are not lizard-eaters." "I've seen it happen," said Campbell somberly. "On Earth and Mars and Mercury, and the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, little people, driven from their homes, robbed of their way of life, exploited for the gaping idiots in the trade centers, little people who didn't care about progress and making money, little people who only wanted to live and breathe and be left alone." He got up in a swift savage rush and hurled a gourd of water crashing into a corner and sat down again. He was shivering. The old Kralin turned. "Little people like you, my son." Campbell shrugged. "Maybe.
We'd worked our farm for 300 years. My father didn't want to sell. They condemned it anyhow. It's under water now, and the dam runs a hell of a big bunch of factories.
I'm sorry.
Campbell looked up, and his face softened. I'd never understood, he said. You people are the most law-abiding citizens I ever met. You don't like strangers. And yet I blunder in here, hot on the lam and ugly as a swamp dragon, and you...
He stopped.
It was probably the excitement that was making his throat knot up like that. The smoke from the lamp stung his eyes. He blinked and bent to trim it.
You were wounded, my son, and in trouble. Your quarrel with the police was none of ours. We would have helped anyone. And then, while you had fever and your guard was down, you showed that more than your body needed help. We gave you what we could.
Yeah, said Kemble huskily. He didn't say it, but he knew well enough that what the Kralans had given him had kept him from blowing his top completely. Now the Kralans were going the way of the others, straws swept before the great broom of progress. Nothing could stop it. Earth's empire surged out across the planets, building, bartering, crashing across time and custom and race to make money and the shining steel cage of efficiency. A cage wherein a sheep could live happily enough, well fed and opulent. But Campbell wasn't a sheep. He'd tried it, and he couldn't bleat in tune. So he was a wolf now, alone and worrying the flock. Soon there wasn't going to be a place in the solar system where a man could stand on his own feet and breathe. He felt stifled. He got up and stood in the doorway, watching the trees stir in the hot indigo gloom. The trees would go, wells and mines, slag and soot and clattering machinery, and men in sweat-stained shirts laboring night and day to get, to grow, to produce. Campbell's mouth twisted, bitter and sardonic. He said softly, God help the unconstructive. The old Kralan murmured, What happened to those others, my son? Campbell's lean shoulders twitched. Some of them died, some of them submitted. The rest? He turned suddenly, so suddenly that the old man flinched. Campbell's dark eyes had a hot light in them, and his face was sharply alive. The rest, he said evenly, went to Romany. He talked, then, urgently pacing the hut in nervous cat-like strides, trying to remember things he had heard and not being very much interested in at the time. When he was through, the Kralan said, It would be better, infinitely better, but... He spread his long, pale hands, and his white crest drooped. But there is no time. Government men will come within 3 days to take us. That was the time set, and since we will not go... Campbell thought of the things that had happened to other rebellious tribes. He felt sick, but he made his voice steady. We'll hope it's time, Father. Romany is in an orbit around Venus now. I nearly crashed it coming in. I'm going to try, anyhow. If I don't, well, stall as long as you can. Remembering the drum and the way the men had looked, he didn't think that would be long. He pulled on a loose shirt of green spider silk, slung the belt of his heavy needle gun over one shoulder, and picked up his black tunic. He put his hand on the Kralan's shoulder and smiled. We'll take care of it, Father. The old man's opalescent eyes were shadowed. I wish I could stop you. It is hopeless for us, and you are... Hot is the word. Campbell grinned. Hot, he said, is the word. Blistering. The Coalition get awfully mad when someone pulls their own hijacking stunt on them. But I'm used to it. It was beginning to get light outside. The old man said quietly, The gods go with you, my son. Campbell went out, thinking he'd need them. It was full day when he reached his hidden ship, a sleek, souped-up cruiser that had the legs of almost anything in space. He paused briefly by the airlock, looking at the sultry green of Lea trees under a pearl-gray sky, the white mist lapping around his narrow waist. He spent a long time over his charts, feeding numbers to the computers. When he got a setup that suited him, he took the ship up on purring copters, angling out over the deep swamps. He felt better with the ship under his hands. The patrol blanket was thin over the deep swamps, but it was vigilant. Campbell's nerves were tight. They got tighter as he came closer to the place where he was going to have to begin his loop over to the night side. He was just reaching for the drive switch when the little red light started to flash on the indicator panel. Somebody had a detector beam on him, and he was morally certain that the somebody was flying a patrol boat.